are friends with Fantasy Benefits.
Mike, how hard are you right now?
Oh, man, I've been hard since you said, hi, welcome to Friends with Fantasy Benefits podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Friends with Fantasy Benefits. You're going to hear a solo podcast tonight, which you almost never hear, but there was some late turmoil within Evan and within Ben, and I had already written down some notes, and so I'm going to very methodically go over a player list with you guys, and maybe more so in depth, I'll be able to give you some some overanalyze, be able to slowly go through some of these statistics that I often throw at you guys, and you will be able to further know what I think these various statistics mean. I, of course, am Chuck Anderson. I can be reached at Just Chucking It on Twitter. I enjoy taking Twitter questions. I regularly take Twitter questions and get Twitter comments every week. I tweet only about baseball as a generality, unless I feel like doing some quirky TV or pop culture kind of reference here and there, but that doesn't happen very often. What we did for a player list this week is we decided that we were going to go into a bunch of young players and then one old player whose appeal to the pundits seems to have no end whatsoever. But the first kid that we're going to talk about, or I'm going to talk about this week, is Andrew Benintendi. Trying to figure out exactly how we're going to rank him going forward and how much value he has going forward, which he is a very interesting case. He was a former number one prospect by a few different prospect analysis sites. He just turned 23 years old, I think 4 days ago. He never had more than 8 stolen bases or 8 home runs in the minors. Now, this is the first thing we can kind of delve into further. You know, when a player is 23, now, we can't expect him to have completely blossomed. I mean, he was kind of a boy, to put it in layman's terms, when he was in the minor leagues. But surprisingly enough, with a history that did not have him having more than 8 stolen bases or 8 home runs in the minors, he has 9 stolen bases right now and 12 home runs right now. So, and there's still plenty of time left in the season, obviously. Other trends that I really like with Andrew Benintendi is that his base on balls percentage is up 2%, while his K percentage is down 1.2% from last year being his rookie season. And I really like that because you want to know that he's controlling the strike zone better. So if he's taking more walks and he's striking out less, those numbers are going exactly in the right direction. Another bit of interesting trivia minutia, if you will, is that his BABIP, his batting average on balls that he puts in play, last year it was 367, and this year it's 298. So he's been very productive, and obviously he's going to be part of a very productive offense going forward. But his luck has gone down a little bit. I mean, 298 is certainly a sustainable rate, somewhere between sustainable and slightly low for a hitter of Benintendi's prospect status or his, his background. But you can expect that there is some upward mobility there going forward. So I think even in a racked and stacked outfield in shallower leagues, especially leagues where you only need 3 outfielders, I think Benintendi has some definite upside. Both the spending power and the farm system of the Boston Red Sox has been very much hailed, and so you would have to think that he's going to get plenty of support going forward. He already has Mookie Betts, who's going to be there long term. Obviously, Rafael Devers is going to be there soon enough, and between the stellar pitching that the Red Sox acquire and the fact that they have the spending power to keep up in free agency and pick some people up to help that lineup even further, I think there's a lot to look forward to with Benintendi. I think it's pretty safe to say that Andrew Benintendi will be a top 20 outfielder next year and going forward. So if there's a big trade that's happening within your league as we come up on the trade deadline, I think acquiring Benintendi in keeper leagues is a very, very good option. Now, continuing the theme and going along with these super sophomores is one Alex Bregman, who's 23 years old and is an Astros third baseman mostly this year. He has 7 home runs and 4 stolen bases, and much like Benintendi that I may not have mentioned, he has 3 caught stealings as well. So his rate hasn't been very good. Benintendi's has been closer to league average. So Bregman's K rate is down 7% from last year, and that's one of the few bright spots in the statistics, because the 33 runs scored and the 29 RBI is just not good enough, to put it plain and simple. So I strongly believe that that Bregman is sort of looking the other way. Now, Benintendi, who's going to get drafted as a top 20 outfielder, I think the one thing about Bregman is that Bregman should be going really late in drafts, or he should come on the cheap if, you know, if you're looking to have him thrown into a trade, because he really hasn't shown much at this level yet. But Bregman, like Benintendi, is, you know, is a key figure in a really, really good lineup that looks like it's going to be chocked full of hitting for years to come. So it's kind of hard to give up on a guy. And I also want to remind people that rumors and reports and, you know, analysis from people down on the farm claim that Bregman is a better shortstop than Carlos Correa is. And so it was really a matter of, you know, Correa being the number one pick and being called up first, that puts Correa at short instead of Bregman. But it also means for years going forward, if Correa was to get hurt and miss time, then it would be very likely that Bregman would get in-season shortstop eligibility and may even get shortstop eligibility the following year if he were to get in 20 games at shortstop. So there is some stuff to like, but there's a lot to not like about how this quote-unquote sophomore season has happened for Bregman. I don't think that with the depth at third base, I don't think you're going to see Alex Bregman go within the top 15 third basemen in next year's drafts. He obviously has some ability and some post-hype sleeper kind of ability, but it's going to be interesting to see exactly where he falls with people. And he's done a lot to dampen the excitement that people had going into the year for Alex Bregman. The league that I own Bregman in, I have him on the ultra cheap in a long-term keeper league. So I'm hoping for some of the scenarios that I explained to you guys just a second ago. Okay, let's move on to the other side, or the other side of your general stat sheet, and let's talk about some young pitchers. The first of which is Aaron Sanchez, who is back off the DL again and has had some promising starts as of late. Just 25 years old. In 2016, he had 30 starts with a little over 7.5 Ks per nine and a little under 3 walks per nine, which is acceptable. And obviously, he was very, very functional for a surging Blue Jays team at the time with lots of offense. Interestingly enough, his ground ball percentage is down 9% this year, but I take very little stock in his stats this year, and I want to take a few seconds and explain why. Number one, he's had a blister problem, and there's been various sightings around the league of people claiming that the upswing in blister injuries, cuts on fingers, etc., has something to do with the new baseball itself. The seams on the baseball have been lowered, and that has increased the amount of pressure that pitchers have to put on those seams to try and get the balls to, you know, have the action on them, the sink or the movement on them that pitchers used to create much more easily. So I really, it's more interesting and goes more in depth than just that. What we have now is we have the league sort of taking the balls and studying them and claiming that they're doing that for safety concerns for the players, not so much as a concern of the upswing in power. So there's a few different ways to take this about Sanchez. First of all, if the league has some concerns about it and they're looking into it, it's likely that next year's baseball won't be exactly the same as this year's baseball. So the average going, stat line for Aaron Sanchez going forward may get a significant boost from a completely outside source, meaning that that a lot of the skills that we saw in Aaron Sanchez as a 24-year-old, we could see again as a 26-year-old. I also think it's unlikely that a 25-year-old guy has his career curtailed by a blister issue. He's a big, strong kid. I know he didn't get a full season worth of work last year, but I would think going forward, he's very likely to get, plenty of work. And as part of a rebuild, he may be looking at some innings concerns going forward next year, as far as maybe, having an inning ceiling. But I also think this year is going to really, really take him off of people's radars. He's only got 32 innings pitched now, basically at the halfway point in the season, and a lot of the concerns about him, involved the fact that people were concerned about how much of a K guy that he would be, because his numbers for K per nine in the upper minors, there's a 6.75, there was a 7.2, a 5.95, the 8.31. I mean, some of these are smaller sample sizes, but the point is that since way back in 2012 at A-ball, he hasn't struck out more than a batter per inning, and most of his numbers are well below like 7.3 as far as K per nine. Now, he also had he had control issues in the minors, and that's something that we need to watch very closely for him on the major league level. He was down to 2.95 bases on balls per nine innings in his breakout season of 2016. But he really only had one stop in the minors that was close to that. And he had a bunch of, 4-plus walks per nine, which is especially concerning for a guy like Sanchez. When you do have a higher K per or a higher walk per nine, you want to see a guy have a higher K per nine to help him be able to get out of jams, and it doesn't per se look like that's going to happen. Most importantly, I would just like to say I think that Aaron Sanchez is a guy that people may give up on for next year, and perhaps wrongfully. While he doesn't have huge upside, I still think it's hard to predict, which direction the K per nine will go. Meaning, I wouldn't be stunned if his K per nine next year is closer to eight, like it was for some various stints in the minors. And he's going to be especially fresh because he's not going to have a whole lot of innings that he put on that arm this year. So Aaron Sanchez is a guy that I would look for to bounce back next year. His unbelievably enough, his FIP right now is 5.71. So while his ERA is 3.94, which is certainly usable, FIP is telling you there's a lot more to be concerned about in the numbers that we've seen this year. But I think he's been searching for a feel and been pitching injured most of the year. So this is something that I think you will see. You will see much closer to a 2016 version of Aaron Sanchez next year than you will a 2017, and he won't come at nearly the cost. So he is someone, if you're in rebuild mode in Dynasty, if you can get somebody to throw Aaron Sanchez in, he's somebody that I think you need to take a serious look at, because I think you could see a 2 or 3 year stretch after this year that represents a serious bounce back in his numbers. So the other super sophomore, in case you didn't see how you know how tenuously linked these players are that I'm going over, is a 24-year-old American League pitcher named Michael Fulmer. The less ballyhooed Fulmer, because it seemed like Carson Fulmer was the one you heard about more in college. But Michael Fulmer, being 24 years old, his K per 9 is down to 6.33 Ks per 9. His strand rate is down 8%, which is good. And his ground ball percentage is up 1.4% to 50.4%, which is also good. I mean, half the time people hitting the ball on the ground, you know, extra base hit damage is definitely limited by ground balls, etc., and so forth. Now, he has a 3.76, he had a 3.76 FIP in 2016, and he has a 3.22 FIP in 17. And oddly enough, what I'm basically hearing from other outlets is that people are really down on Fulmer because of that strikeout rate being down to 6.33. And I guess within this pitching environment, I just don't really see that. You know, he's never been less than very effective. He had two pretty bad starts about a month and a half ago, but he has been very, very successful at the major league level. Now, you know, and to add to this, I want to mention that I really think it's safe to say that he's growing into a workhorse. In he had 26 starts in 2016 and threw 159 innings. Okay, this year in 18 starts, he has 123 innings. So obviously, you know, eight more starts puts him, you know, well over. At the pace that he's at now, would put him well over the 170, 180 innings point. So he's really been doing the Tigers a favor by pitching as deep into games as he has been already at the ripe age of 24. I think people are getting overly critical and maybe a little greedy when it comes to Fulmer. While that 6.33 K per nine will keep him out of the ace level, I certainly think he can be more than serviceable as a number two pitcher. And that big ground ball rate is something that that adds to his viability of being able to do just that. There's so much to like about what Michael Fulmer has done so far, and I just find it really hard to believe that people are going to go out of their way to avoid him fully next year. And if people are doing that, I think that's something that you need to jump on, because he's one of those guys. He seems to be like a will to win guy. He's doing all the right things at basically, at all the right times. The other thing I didn't even mention is, people's least favorite statistic, but he won 11 games in 2016, and he's already won 10 this year. So there's an awful lot to like about the direction that everything is going in. You know, the BABIP is virtually the same from last year, 268 last year, 266 this year. Like I said, his strand rate is down, so he's getting less lucky. That explains what's going on with the FIP. You know, his home run to fly ball is way down, which means he's inducing weaker contact in general. So I really went into this exercise thinking I was going to see a really large kink in his armor somewhere. But when you don't have to strike out as many people, he's walking less than two runners per nine innings, and you don't have to strike out as many people. He's also basically cut his home runs per nine innings down, in half. It was 0.91, so he's given up almost a home run per nine last year, and it's down to 0.51, so it's almost half a home run. So I see all these different things and all this effectiveness. I also see, as I've stated before, an AL Central that is probably getting weaker going forward. I don't think that the Indians are going to be spenders long term. They haven't been for any stretch in the past. The Twins seem to be at least a few years from contention, and the White Sox should still be taking significant lumps next year as far as their rebirth or their renaissance of these young players that everyone's all excited about right now. And that's not even going into the Royals, who are obviously going to lose at least two or three of the main cogs of their lineup. So I do believe Michael Fulmer is being, you know, overly criticized, and not for good reason right now within the fantasy industry. So he's someone that I would also covet as someone, if you can acquire him, and someone that I think will be undervalued next year. If you have plenty of other K upside guys within your, or you plan on drafting K's throughout, I think Michael Fulmer is the kind of guy that you can sort of anchor your team around for being solidly productive, because we've seen nothing but that at the major league level. Okay, let's talk about another sophomore season, and from another guy who's less than 25 years old. And that's one Gary Sanchez, who is, of course, the catching phenom for the Yankees. He's going through some different kind of criticism right now. There's outlets I've heard talking about, you know, criticizing his catching and sort of his leadership ability within the team. And naturally, the microscope is always crazy when it comes to anything that involves the Yankees. We've seen this year in and year out. There is some interesting things going on within Gary Sanchez's stat line right now. The first thing that I never really had taken notice of before is that in 2016, Gary Sanchez stole 8 bases between AAA and the big leagues in 124 games. He's got 2 steals for the Yankees this year in 60 games. Well, 63 games if you count his minor league rehab stint. But it certainly does not appear that Gary Sanchez is a zero in stolen bases. He actually had 11 stolen bases in 2012. He had 7 in 2015. So, you know, those aren't overly impressive numbers, but I don't think I've heard enough mention of the fact that Gary Sanchez is not a zero in stolen bases at the catcher's position, especially as stolen bases has become more and more of a scarce stat for us fantasy players to try and accumulate. Now, the crazy home run percentage that we saw last year, you know, he had 20 home runs in 53 games at the major league level. Well, this year he's got 14 home runs in 60 games, so it's obviously slowing down a good deal. But he's also spent some time on the DL this year. His BABIP is actually up. It was 317 last year. It's 320 this year at the major league level. So, you know, it's 350. He's got a 357 OBP and a 496 slugging. So he's well above average for a catcher. And the real question that it comes down to when you're trying to project what kind of value Gary Sanchez has going forward, some of it comes down to your theory about what to do about catching. In all the years that I've played fantasy baseball, I don't think I've ever seen catcher quite this bad. I actually was kind of thinking there might be a bounce back sort of in the lower ranks. A bunch of the also-ran catchers would come back to formidability. And that just really hasn't happened. I mean, you got a little bit from Tyler Flowers, and you've gotten something from Alex Avila. But most of the low-level catchers have been around absolute zero. Then to add insult to injury, Wilson Ramos comes back from his long-standing knee injury that cost him all that free agency money, and he went on the DL, and he just got back again. So there's been a lot of there's been an influx of bad catching, meaning that, you know, as Jonathan Lucroy has gone down, that's really hurt some of the depth at the catcher position as well. We haven't gotten some people like Wellington Castillo, and I see he's right around just getting to double digits in home runs. So we haven't gotten much from him, despite the fact of him being in that Orioles lineup. So, you know, the Rockies catching situation has really not reaped anyone the hopes that people thought that maybe it would going into the year. So there's been, you know, whoever's caught for the Brewers has basically been pretty good this year, and that's one of the few bright spots. But I strongly believe that going forward, between Yankee Stadium and between the fact that we've now, you know, getting up there as far as, you know, we're now getting over 113 games in the bigs for 115 total, if I'm looking here correct, which I think I am, 115 total, if you include two games that he had in 2015, you're getting to the point where you're getting almost a full season's worth of work for most catchers. And he's a strong enough hitter that he's going to spend some extra time DHing when he's right. I strongly believe with Buster Posey aging, et cetera, that Gary Sanchez could be a better draft day deal next year. He's a better draft value than Posey, and I think he's someone that should be coveted next year in drafts. It's just, it's been drilled into me that in two catcher leagues, especially, you can't have 2-0 positions for hitting amongst your hitters and expect for everyone else to make up for it. And so the advantage that I used to think was overblown with drafting catcher early, it's gone away from me now. I have a hard time seeing that anymore. I just think that there's so little at catcher that it's created almost a positional scarcity situation. And you're talking about a guy who's got 34 home runs in 113 games, you know, the last 2 years at the big league level. And it's hard for me not to envision that he's going to hold a lot of value being in the middle of that lineup and being able to run a little bit and take advantage of the ballpark going forward. And again, like I said before when I was judging Benintendi, the Yankees, although they've been more frugal in recent years, the Yankees are a team that at some point is really going to infuse that lineup with some extra, you know, spending on some extra free agents. So Gary Sanchez in his sophomore year, I think his effectiveness is getting overlooked. And I was as shocked as anyone. I didn't realize that Sanchez has a likelihood to steal, you know, around five bases, maybe plus in a full year of work. So draft or acquire Sanchez for next year and hope for health, because it'll be a huge advantage over the rest of your league mates to have a catcher that could eclipse 90 RBIs pretty easily in a full season, being in the middle of a lineup like that. So maybe I would say his upward mobility is somewhere around 75 or 80 runs, which would be a lot for a catcher as well. You know, being in the American League helps, but and hitting as high up as he could hit. He could hit third, fourth, or fifth pretty easily in that Yankee lineup. Okay, one more player that I really want to touch on with you guys. I know it's going to end up being a little bit shorter pod, but I wanted to put something out there for you guys the best I could. But one of the guys I wanted to touch on has sort of been one of my longstanding pet peeves. And you guys out there that listen to my show with Darius and Justin, that comes out a little later in the week, will know that I'm sort of famous for ranting, and I really haven't gone off yet on this guy as much as I would like to. And that's one Jeff Samardzija, who's had obviously an interesting career. You know, he was a wide receiver at Notre Dame. He chose baseball over football, which, you know, has certainly worked out to a large extent, especially since it's, you know, it's less dangerous, etc. But I just want to mention that every year now we have Samardzija, who's 32 years old, you know, and every single year it seems like people want to buy into him as a sleeper candidate, that he's, you know, that he's undervalued. You know, now he's in San Francisco, so that's the reason that he's suddenly going to start succeeding. And somehow or another, you know, Jeff Samardzija has just never really been a complete pitcher. you know, this year all of the pundits are going crazy because, you know, he's got this 9.8 Ks per nine. His walk rate is the lowest that it's ever been at the major league level. You know, he's still giving up quite a few home runs, especially considering where he pitches, you know, almost 1.5 per nine. You know, but he's had some bad BABIP luck, which, you know, 329 against. You know, his left on base percentage is down. So obviously he's given up hits at the wrong time. His ground ball percentage is down almost 4%. Which, you know, isn't ideal, but you get away with fly balls pretty readily at your home park in San Francisco. You want to be careful when you're pitching on the road in Colorado or Arizona for such a thing. So his ERA right now stands at 4.86 for the year, and that's with 124 innings and 19 starts. And his FIP is 3.52, and his xFIP is even lower at 3.08. So it's a lot of fun to say, well, he's 4-11, and that's all the Giants' fault, et cetera, and so forth. But last year, Samardzija had 12 wins, and that's the most wins he's ever had in his career. Wins is a much beleaguered stat where people think it's just all random luck. And to an extent, maybe it is. But now we have a guy who's, you know, first stint in the bigs, real stint was 2009. Now it's, you know, we're going into 9 years later, nine years after that, and he still has not been, you know, he's only been a double-digit winner at the major league level twice. So there's certainly a lot to be said for that. You know, this year is going to lead more and more people to thinking that, you know, that next year is the year that you want him, and, you know, he's going to be this great late end game flyer. And I'm just going to suggest that maybe at, you know, when going into his age 33 season next year, and a guy who's basically never put together a solid, you know, top 20 style season as a major league pitcher, maybe it's time to give up the fight now. Maybe we've gone far enough. The Giants certainly look like they're going to be in rebuild mode offensively. So I don't see a whole lot to be excited about from the team standpoint next year. Also, playing the Dodgers, playing the Rockies, playing the Diamondbacks more than the other teams in the league does not appear to be like a very healthy environment either, as far as facing decent offenses. So there's a lot going in the wrong direction that I look at. And maybe, you know, I'm being reactionary to an extent, but he's had, you know, FIPs around this 3.52 before. You know, he had a 3.55 FIP in 2012. He had a 3.2 FIP in 2014, which was basically his best season, which also had his lowest BABIP that he had given up, you know, has given up ever since 2011. In 2014, his BABIP was only 285, so, or 283 in 2014. So I wonder when people are going to start to give up on this. He's always been a high usage guy. He's had some good stretches in seasons, and he's had some completely miserable stretches in seasons. He's a big, tall guy. Obviously, he's struggled at various times with control and giving up the long ball. I just wonder sometimes when people will ever give up the fight with somebody. And this is a prime example of a time I think maybe it's time to do exactly that and throw in the towel when it comes to Jeff Samardzija, who I'm not overly excited about. One more thing, besides just pointing out stuff on these players that we've gone through, one more thing I want to touch on is we got into a Twitter debate, and it might have been in the Facebook group as well that we ended up getting into it. I have a very distinct belief when it comes to trade vetoes. I think if you're going to be in a league that has keepers in it, there's almost no such thing as a vetoable trade. We had a very good friend of Friends with Fantasy Benefits, one of our actual contributors, Andrew Dewhurst, I believe, who admitted that he got self-serving when it came to a veto, and that he actually vetoed a trade, not because he thought the trade was unfair, but because he wanted to protect his position in the standings. And Andrew is a great guy by all accounts, and he's been wonderful to us. But this was not a shining moment, in my opinion, and this is exactly the reason that I'm against trade vetoes, and I actually would not allow any leagues that I create going forward to have a trade veto system. There's no way that anyone is a soothsayer and knows for sure exactly what's going to happen in these various leagues going forward that are keeper leagues. And I'm going to tell a story of the longest standing league that I'm in now. I've been in for almost 20 years. A few years ago, out of nowhere, a trade snuck through that was David Ortiz was traded to the eventual winner of the league for Nolan Arenado. And this was long enough ago that Arenado had not come into his own and wouldn't come into his own for a couple of years yet. And I got some emails and such, people asking me what I thought about the trade. And the gentleman who traded Ortiz was brand new to the league that year. And he really was obviously getting his feet wet with fantasy baseball and didn't really understand player values. And while I took second that year, I was never bitter about the fact that I told everyone that that was not a trade that they should veto. It was really the start of the surge 4 or 5 years ago. It was the start of the surge of the late surge that was David Ortiz. And it certainly sealed the deal for the guy who received Ortiz. But I wasn't willing to say that I really had any idea what Nolan Arenado was going to be. And when you trade for a guy who plays for the Rockies, you always have to know exactly how much upside and how much potential there is if a person hits a groove and plays their home games in Denver. So as it turned out, I was, it cost me. I still strongly believed, I went by with my strong belief that that was not a vetoable trade. In the years that followed, there was multiple times that trades, you could see that trades that involved people that were towards the end of the standings, those trades went through without much ado. But any trade that involved somebody in first, second, third, fourth place, anybody in contention, those trades had either squeaked through or didn't go through at all, despite the fact that they involved, numerous prospects. Now let's talk about what's wrong with vetoing a trade. The first part about vetoing a trade that I don't like is a lot of what I just said. That's the soothsayer aspect, that you're pretending like you understand what's going to happen in the future. Even if a side gets more back in a trade, which certainly happens. It happens at the major league level all the time. Even if that happens, you don't know that the players received are going to actually stay healthy, are actually going to keep performing, etc. Then on top of it, the thing that I really don't like about trade vetoes is that most of the time when people veto trades, they don't actually take the time to look at the actual teams, the actual fantasy teams involved. It would seem utterly ridiculous if a person had three really good shortstops that they couldn't play all the time. It would seem utterly ridiculous to trade, say, Xander Bogaerts for Billy Hamilton right now. But when it comes to categories, that trade could make perfect sense. If you're not really getting a use out of Bogaerts and you really need to catch up in stolen bases, then that trade makes perfect sense for that owner. And I don't think it's anybody's right to say how another owner should run their team. And the fact that I see these vetoes going on, even in keeper leagues, is really, really disturbs me. It makes me think the worst of humanity. It really does. I think most of the trade vetoes that happen through pure jealousy is most of it. These other owners wish that they could have gotten to that owner first. They didn't realize that this one owner was devaluing a player while other owners in the league really valued them a lot more highly. Well, that is fantasy baseball in a nutshell. And when you think about all the certainties that we have in our mind going into a year that turn out to be anything but that, I go back to this prognosticating part of a trade veto. There's no way, shape, or form that people know exactly what's going to happen going forward. That's where the fun of the game comes in. So do yourself and your league a favor and try and step back and think to yourself, if these two people are not colluding, if they're, not best friends where the one guy is just giving up for the other person to win, if there's no evidence of that, there's no thought of it, if both sides are giving something up, something of value, then as far as I'm concerned, there's no way that that trade can be vetoed. And if you're going to set up a league, if you're the commissioner, I think you should be able to be considered level-headed enough that instead of having the trade veto process, I think you should give yourself a couple days, a window to make sure that you can see the trades as a commissioner, and then you should allow almost every trade scenario you could imagine to go through, because that is fantasy baseball. The fun of it is that sometimes we get crackpot ideas in our head. We want to acquire players, etc., where other people might not be thinking of them. We have our pet theories. That's part of the game. And restricting trades restricts the fun of fantasy baseball, and it goes against the spirit of the league. It can create hard feelings. And it's absolutely could not be more so the wrong approach to take when it comes to your leagues with your friends or your leagues online. Stay away from trade vetoes and realize that people need the variables or the variance to run their teams exactly how they want to. All right. Well, obviously, this is a little bit shorter than what you're used to, but I did manage to ramble for a while because I'm a loudmouth and I'm long-winded. But I am Chuck Anderson, and I can be reached at Just Chucking It. And I will be putting out an Of Note column for the Friends with Fantasy Benefits website yet this week. I strongly appreciate the listen. This is nothing like Paul Spohr's 3 hours of delving into pitchers by himself a few weeks ago. But at the same time, I wanted to go over the players because there was a definite reason that we wanted to talk about these guys. And I thought we haven't touched base on these guys enough going through. And this sort of gives us an extra bit of info, an extra spot where we can look at these guys going forward. So thank you so much for your time. This is Chuck Anderson signing off for Friends with Fantasy Benefits. Every night.